hill as a soldier climbs in the saddle for one last ride. As the rain pours off his head,
how appropriate. The Last Rebel by Lynyrd Skynyrd. And folks, welcome to Rebel Madman Radio here on Republic Broadcasting Network here on the 22nd day of April in the year of 2023. First of all, I would like to ask all of you to please go to rbnrepublicbroadcasting.org and to make a donation to keep the station up and going so we can process free speech, which is coming in short supply these days. Well, folks, I got to tell you, this is just absolutely a pleasure for me because I was just talking with my friend of several years here, and we, before the program actually started, we remembered that we were first on the radio together 18 years ago this month. So welcome, everyone, to Mr. James Edwards of the Political Cesspool. James, how are you, my friend?
Mike, I'm always good when I'm in your company, brother. And that is something. We went on the air in the fall of 2004. So a little later this year, we'll have celebrated 19 full years on the air. But that April, the April of 05 was our first April on the air. And you were there. And I think, you know, we joked about this the last time we talked. If you'd have told me 18 years ago that we'd still be talking on the radio 18 years later, I don't know if I would have believed it, but God is good.
Oh, absolutely, buddy. And of course, I was down as one of the leaders of the Minuteman Project, and I was doing a daily call-in from a phone booth, people, was talking with James on the Political Cesspool back then, and I was giving him daily updates on the Minuteman Project from the border in Arizona. And that turned out to be quite the month, didn't it, brother?
I tell you what, I can't talk about being baptized in fire. Again, we'd only been on the air a handful of months, a little less than a half a year, I guess, or right at a half a year. And that was really our first really burst into heavy hitting. You and the great Joe McCutcheon. But yes, I think that really does date us if you think about it, because I know you could talk to kids now who have no idea what a payphone is. That was 18 years ago. I mean, you can't even, they don't have them anymore. You maybe in a museum, and you calling, walking to that trading post there on the United States border with Mexico and calling in with updates from the Minuteman Project, which was major national news back in the spring of 2005. Yep, 18 years ago and still here today, still trying to fight for our people and celebrate our ancestors. We fight for the past, the present, and the future.
Absolutely, brother. And, you know, you embarked this month, began 3 weeks ago up the Dixie Republic. You embarked every month on Confederate History Month. You want to tell the folks a little bit about how James Edwards handles Confederate History Month at the Political Cesspool?
Well, you know, Mike, we cut our teeth on Southern heritage-related issues. I mean, I guess that month with you was when we first really started to get some big guests, Pat Buchanan's sister, Babe Buchanan. I remember her coming on that month, and then, of course, later Pat would come on many times in his own right. And I got my start working for Pat in 2000. But as far as activism outside of the studio, there was a big battle back right around that same time, 2004, 2005, 2006, in the city of Memphis, which is where we're located, about renaming the Confederate parks and removing the monuments. And we fought some battles on that front. And so throughout the year, I mean, we're always intermittently talking about Southern heritage related issues and honoring our ancestors and things like that. But in the month of April, we really put a special emphasis on it because April is Confederate History Month. That isn't something we made up. Some states in the South still to this day celebrate it by official government proclamation. The state of Tennessee did it this year, as did the state of Mississippi, and there may have been some others. Used to, all of the old Confederate states would issue a governmental or gubernatorial proclamation designating April as Confederate History Month, because, of course, the war began and ended in April 1861 to 1865. So it is that. And during that month, we feature exclusively feature this month guests who are coming on to talk about things pertaining to that issue. We have two special series throughout the year. And in the other 10 months, we're talking about news and current events as talk radio hosts would want to do. But in March, we do a special series, March Around the World, during which we feature only international guests. We check in on our people in various ports of call throughout the Western world and beyond, elected officials, thought leaders, things like that. And then in April, it's Confederate History Month. So as you mentioned, we had a great book launch back on April 1st in Travelers Rest, South Carolina, talking about the new book that we have out, which, of course, was designed to be released during Confederate History Month of this year. It's called The Honorable Cause, A Free South. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit later. But several of the authors were up there. Great crowd, great group of people. I missed you there. You and I were there for the Dixie Fest last year. But maybe we'll get together a little later on this year. But above and beyond that, we had just last week, for instance, John Hill, who is the last living descendant of the Confederate General A.P. Hill, Ambrose Powell Hill. Mm-hmm. And I got this one guy, he's really our weak link, but we got this one guy named Mike Gaddy. He's going to be closing our Confederate
series
next week. So it's always a good lineup. And I tell you, Mike, we have listeners like RBN from certainly across the South, but really across the entire United States and around the world. We have listeners in all 50 states, and this is something that everybody enjoys. You do not have to have Southern patrimony to enjoy the Confederate History Month. I think increasingly our flag, that beautiful St. Andrew's cross, has become a symbol not just of our ancestors, but of resistance to tyranny and oppression around the world. And a lot of people, I get more emails about this particular series from people outside of the South than anything else we do. So it's a big hit. It's always a big hit. And of course, you're always a big hit. I'm really excited to have you on TPC next week to close out the series. We'll have a good time.
Oh, I'll be honored to be there as always, sir. And one of the things I kind of wanted to point out, because I'm kind of the rebel madman here at RBN. And so here's some things. I think we are deficient in our history in so many respects. And I mean, as a country, not as individuals, but as a country. And here is one of the things that really struck me some time back, but I wanted to bring it up today for sure. And the question would be, how many are aware that the exact same political dynamics which prompted the Federalists to create a new constitution in 1787 is the exact same political dynamic which brought on the Civil War? And some people might say, well, how did that happen? Well, we have to understand that 1783, the war was over, and then Americans had to pretty much be on their own, because they had to come up with their own government. They had to come up with their own commerce. They had to do all these things. But the problem was that the people were hooked on British goods. And so they wanted to keep importing British goods, even though the war was over. And the industrial North started manufacturing, but their goods were not of the quality that was coming from England, and they could not compete in the marketplace. So the Northern states almost immediately put in a high tariff, which hurt the people of the Northern states, because now they had to pay a much higher price for the goods, either that or to buy the, at the time, substandard goods from the northern manufacturers. So politically, the manufacturing states of the North imposed those high protective tariffs for the benefit of their manufacturers, while the South, that didn't have that manufacturing base, wanted to keep their prices low on their imported, and you can't blame them for that. They wanted to keep their prices low. Well, the problem was, back then, you had actually had states' rights. The states could have a lower tariff if they wanted it. And so the South insisted upon keeping the lower tariff. But the growing manufacturing of Pennsylvania and the rest of the North, especially New England, now wanted to secure the large southern market for themselves. Even enjoying the mild tariffs of the South, they could not successfully compete with the more efficiently produced and lower cost English goods, or even at that point with English shipping. Hence, the northern manufacturers concluded that a nationalist system in which only the federal government could set a uniform tariff was important for monopolizing the southern market, at the expense, of course, of the southern consumers and any of the consumers of the low-tariff states. Hence, the artisans, manufacturers of the North began to look with favor on the old monarchist idea of a strong, overriding central government, and they began to ally their important mass support with the long-standing schemes of the northern financial oligarchy, or what we call the banking complex or the banking cabal. So this, in essence, James, is exactly the same thing that led to the Civil War. That high tariff, that moral tariff, was kind of what kicked it over the edge. But here we have to understand the importance of states' rights as opposed to a strong central government, was that the people of the South had the right to put the tariff in their states at whatever level they wanted to. And that would keep, and that would protect the people of their states, whereas the North didn't care about the people, except they cared about the manufacturers and the people who were selling goods, and they wanted to protect them. And of course, once we had that highly central government under the Constitution, it was controlled primarily by northern interest all the way until 1860, into that period. Plus, the other thing I think that we have to consider here, James, is that, and most people don't know this, but the North was just as insistent as the South that slavery be embraced in the Constitution, because so much of the shipping was coming out of northern ports. Boston, New York, Rhode Island, they were handling the majority of the shipping of slaves. So they didn't want their profits to go away, so they wanted slavery into the Constitution. As a matter of fact, Ellsworth made the comment when the South said they wanted to count their slaves as, or the blacks, as three-fifths of a person. Actually, they wanted to count them as an entire person, but the North balked and insisted on three-fifths. But then even at that, Oliver Ellsworth made the claim. He said, look, if the South can count their slaves toward voting, we should be able to count our cows, dogs, and chickens. So, and most people aren't aware of that, James, because we're just not taught that down at the Communist Manifesto gulag we call public school.
Well, boy, ain't that the truth, Mike. And you said a mouthful, brother, in your presentation just then. Very informative. Of course, the old saying is there was never a slave that was brought to the United States on a ship that had a Confederate flag flying above it, and that's the truth. Going back further than that, though, to the founding of the country, of course the states were sovereign, hence the Union. It's a collection of states coming together, agreeing to come together to form a union, but the states were sovereign. Now, the states could cede some of their sovereignty for the good of the collective, but certainly it was never intended, I don't believe, for a out-of-touch and tyrannical federal government to subjugate the states or rape them with tariffs, which is, of course, and you mentioned it, that it was tariffs and it was just sort of baked into the cake very early on that this would eventually lead to a separation, and it did. And of course, when it came time, that was the big question. If you had the right to form a union, did you have the right to divorce yourself from that union? And that couldn't be settled politically, so it was litigated by war, and it still, frankly, hasn't been settled, as far as I'm concerned. The founding fathers, even amongst some of our own people, sometimes get a bad rap, and they were obviously the products of their time, as all men are. They were the product of the French Enlightenment, and perhaps they got a little bit too drunk on that Kool-Aid. But with regards to slavery and citizenship, I mean, you know, obviously if you look at the who was allowed to be a citizen, free white men of good character, you mentioned the three-fifths situation. But yeah, I mean, if slavery was the entire issue, I mean, obviously, as you know, and you're the constitutional scholar, I mean, I am a mere student compared to your intellect on these topics, Mike, but obviously the issue of slavery, and not everybody in the South, I mean, you can't say that everybody in the South was fighting for the exact same reasons. I think almost, I don't want to say almost to a man, but the vast majority were obviously fighting to protect their homes and fireside. They were fighting to stave off invasion and to maintain their sovereignty and their independence. It was the Second War of Independence. Now, some people, some business people, maybe even some people in some levels of government had interests, economic interests that were propelled by the slave labor, but that just, I don't believe. Slavery, obviously, and it may have been an issue. It may have been an issue. It was certainly made to be an issue by Lincoln in the middle of the war because the war was lagging. It wasn't looking very good for the Union before Gettysburg. I mean, that was still the end was still very much in doubt. So Lincoln used the Emancipation Proclamation as a political tool, and he was very much an evil genius in terms of his maneuvers as a politician. But that's when that really became. And then, of course, the victors write the history. Now it was all about slavery and nothing else. But, yeah, slavery would have died a natural death, as it did everywhere else except for non-white countries where it still exists. It would have died a natural death in the South with the advent of mechanization and industrialization. You would have had machines that would have done that work, and there's no need to maintain slave labor when a machine can do it more efficiently without the care and upkeep and things like that. So it would have been gone. I think a lot of the Confederate heroes made mention of that, but the idea that it was a good versus evil war entirely over the issue of slavery is, of course, poppycock. That it was the comedian Norm Macdonald, who passed away not too long ago from Saturday Night Live. I mean, he had the good line on all of this. He said he was reading through his history book and the good guys won every single time. So, of course, we know that's not the case, but it is important that there be shows like this that get out that history. And I know you wanted to say a few things about Patrick Henry, which I really want to listen to. I want to hear what you have to say about that, because Patrick Henry, it was his grandson, correct, who fought for the Confederacy. A lot of the descendants of the Founding Fathers fought for the South and not the North.
Well, let's not forget the Jefferson that died at New Market with the VMI cadets.
Yep. There you go.
So, yes, there is, but I think, again, and the South catches hell for this over and over and over, James, but they forget that in 1857, just 3 years before Lincoln's elected, the U.S. Supreme Court codified slavery into the Constitution.
Well, I mean, Mike, you know, you've got a thing now, though, where you could do anything to the people. The people will believe anything. I mean, my goodness, we live in an age now where nobody even knows the difference between what a man and a woman is. You've seen these man on the street interviews that people like Mark Dice do. They can't even name the belligerents in the war between the states. You know, they ask the most simple question: who fought in World War II? Who fought in the Civil War? And they don't know. So if they don't even know who fought, do you think they're going to know the actual reasons for it? And of course, yeah, you just you allow the media and the Marxist public education system to let them know what little they do believe they know, and the results are predictable.
Oh, absolutely. And yes, Patrick Henry predicted the Civil War. Patrick Henry said that if the Constitution passed and was ratified, that it would lead to a terrible Civil War within 100 years. Well, I think it took less than that, but he predicted it. And, you know, again, Patrick Henry was mentioned by many of his fellow, as we call them, founders. He was mentioned as the most devout Christian of the group. And yet, when invited to attend the Constitutional Convention as a delegate from Virginia, receiving
more votes than anyone except for George Washington. And he said, no, I smell a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia. And he refused to go. And no one fought as hard against ratification of the Constitution than did Patrick Henry throughout, you know, the ratification process. His speeches at the Virginia Ratification Convention are epic. And yes, as a good point my friend Cal made, yes, the states were sovereign. They were in charge of their own, but the Constitution changed that, and the federal government became supreme with Article 6. But while living in retirement with his family, Patrick Henry was still practicing law. Most of it was pro bono back then. There was a pamphlet containing the Constitution and the proposed 12 amendments, which had been adopted by the majority of the states, was brought to Patrick Henry and examined by him most carefully in the presence of his son and a Mr. Dandridge. Henry seemed to have been suspicious of the character of some of the framers of the Constitution, no kidding, and of the crafty politicians through whose hands it had passed since its adoption by Virginia. And Patrick Henry feared they had not only altered the amendments adopted by the Virginia Convention, but had tampered with the body of the instrument itself. But after reading it carefully, satisfying himself that they had not changed significantly the original part, he read carefully the amendments, especially the 10th Amendment, what we call the 10th Amendment now. When he read this, he threw down the pamphlet upon the table and was very upset, according to his son and Mr. Dandridge, and his grandson, who was there, the one who served with the Confederacy. And Patrick Henry said, I find that these shrewd northern statesmen have outwitted our southern men again in the wording of these amendments. They determined when the Constitution was framed to make this a great consolidated national government of all of the people of all of the states. To secure this object, they inserted in its preamble the words, we the people of the United States, instead of we the states. Their object was to make it a government of a majority of the whole people, that is, a government of the northern people, for they had the majority, and under such a government holding that power, they can and will exercise it aggressively to the South for their own advantage. To prevent this and to hinder this majority from doing whatever they may think proper for the general welfare, which they will construe to mean their own sectional welfare and not that of the South, Patrick Henry said, I wrote the first 20 amendments that were adopted by the state of Virginia and recommended by the Convention of Virginia in these words, and I quote, each state in the Union shall, respectively, retain every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Constitution delegated to the Congress of the United States or to the departments of the federal government, unquote. Patrick told his grandson, his son, and Mr. Dandridge that he wrote that, and he intended for it to secure the rights of the states and to prevent the exercise of doubtful powers by the federal government, but they left out the wording for that amendment and substituted for it this equivocal thing to which they have tacked the objectionable and dangerous words of the people at the end. Now, most people are totally unaware of what happened at the convention over the 10th Amendment. I mean, at the first Congress, I'm sorry. But the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, here was what happened because we had Richard Henry Lee, another good Southerner, William Grayson, another good Southerner, who fought this. And Richard Henry Lee said when they were debating this in the Senate, he said, why do you put or to the people? Because what you're doing is you're saying that the people in aggregate. He said, otherwise, if you don't mean that, just leave that clause off. And then it would say it are reserved to the states respectively. But they added or to the people. And so then Richard Henry Lee proposed at the convention that you add after or to the people one simple word, thereof, which would have made it totally conclusive that the power rested with the people of the states. But his motion to add thereof at the end was voted down 20-2. So Patrick Henry said they determined to make this a consolidated government. They added these words, or to the people, to neutralize the amendment of Virginia, and they have done it effectually. This government cannot last. It will not last a century without a massive civil war. We can only get rid of its oppression by a most violent and bloody struggle. Henry at once discerned the craft displayed by this ingenious amendment, worded to deceive the conventions of the different states. They were intended to persuade them that they embraced the strong safeguard to their rights furnished by the clear and explicit amendment of Patrick Henry. The amendment does this up to the word respectively. If the amendment had ended there, its meaning could not have been perverted. But the trickery is veiled in the words added, or to the people. They are superfluous verbiage. If they were added to curb federal power and guard state sovereignty, which the amendment was adopted to effect, but they didn't. But the cunning politicians who inserted them did so with a design of using them to suit their purpose when occasion should arise in the future. We are not states respectively with any reserved and sovereign rights. We are a nation ruled first by a northern majority and then by a contemptible minority of oligarchs. The violent and bloody struggle has ensued, and it is not yet ended. The Constitution is destroyed. The government has been overturned, and the century has not yet rolled away. Our present government is not that one framed in Philadelphia. That did not last even a century. The new dominion, which has risen out of it, is changing continually because of the verbiage inserted by the people at the First Congress and the Committee of Style and Arrangement. What it is now is difficult to define. It requires another Patrick Henry to predict. End of quote. Ah, there's the music. We'll be back on the other side, folks. The Last Rebel.
Couldn't have timed that any better.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hi, Tom Bolton for Ease Off. I know so many of you are finding our EZ4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC. 417-932-6419.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Einstein once said, "Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies." What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past, or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new, healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To read more about this amazing breakthrough and to order your terahertz frequency wand, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, you dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Where you get
well, had to get in that gum, word. Had to get in that verbiage right there. A fool's convention. I don't know how anyone could look at this government and come to any other conclusion. Do you, James?
No, I don't. That was a good song. I was thinking during your last comments before the break, we had mentioned a little earlier in the program why the southern states have in the past and still some to this day celebrated April or commemorated April as Confederate History Month, because of course the war started on April the 12th, 1861, and ended on April the 9th, 1865. And it caused me to think, as you were talking about the founding fathers and the founding and the Constitution and how perhaps that poison pill was baked into our very birth. Michael Perutka, who you may know, who's also a constitutional attorney and had been the presidential nominee of the Constitution Party. He actually won a contested primary in Maryland just this last cycle as the Republican nominee. But he had written that America itself was born and died on the 4th of July. Obviously the 4th of July with the Declaration of Independence, and then in Michael Perutka's estimation, America died on the 4th of July, 1863. I went back during the break and found this, which we had posted to my website a few times over the years, typically around the 4th of July, and I'd like to just read it very quickly and get your response, if that's okay, Mike.
Please do.
Here's what Michael Perutka writes about America dying on the 4th of July, 1863. He said, "It was on this day that I always feel a sense of sadness and regret from the historical proximity of the defeat of our American forces at Gettysburg. And I like how he writes, our American forces lost at Gettysburg. On the 4th of July, 1863, after 3 days of brutal and desperate fighting to defend and preserve the American way of life, American soldiers, he's talking about the Confederates, of course, retreated in the rain through Frederick, Maryland, and slipped back across the Potomac River to the relative safety of Virginia. I wonder what Independence Day thoughts went through the minds of these men as they marched away from that horrific scene where they and their brethren had sacrificed life and limb for the cause of American independence. What singular faith and courage led them to continue the struggle to defend America from the growing tyrant? This is where I think it really gets heavy. Though most people living in America today don't realize that the Army of Northern Virginia was the last force capable of countermanding the centralized tyranny that had succeeded in undermining the concept of our republic. When Lee lost at Gettysburg, no earthly force remained that could stand against the Washington Leviathan. This growing monster would eventually murder 50 million innocent babies, would send our daughters and sisters, along with our sons and brothers, off to die stupidly and needlessly in order to satisfy its lust for blood and power. It would undermine fatherhood and our families and seek dominion over our children, would stare at us from every street corner with its cyclops eye to make sure that we have our seatbelt buckled, would number and monitor us, and would drug our children to make sure they grow up without any idea of what liberty means or any knowledge of the true source of law and liberty in government. And I think he's right, of course. I mean, all of that is a result of the war, which is a result of the things you were talking about going back to the very founding of the nation.
Well, thank you for that, James. I am familiar with Mr. Perutka. He and I used to email quite a bit back when he was the Constitution Party candidate, and we talked about quite a few issues. I agree with the theme of what he was saying, but I believe that the groundwork was laid for the Civil War, just as Patrick Henry said. Because the states were no longer sovereign. They were no longer sovereign over their own decisions. And, of course, Patrick Henry also said that the necessary and proper clause, the general welfare clause, would be the windows through which all manners of evil would pass. And he's exactly right. And I think, and my buddy Cal just sent me a text, and he's exactly right. What was born on July the 4th of 1776 died in Philadelphia in 1787.
Well, if there was any question of it, would you say it was settled by the end of 1865?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the culmination. And just the other day on Facebook, I did this just for fun. You know, sometimes I just like to prod people. So I put in there, imagine, if you will, there's a husband and a wife, and the husband is living off of everything that his wife produces. She's working, she's doing everything, and he is just stealing her money and just having a wonderful time. And so she sues for divorce. And he says, no, you can't have a divorce. And so he kills her. And then he becomes a national hero.
That's good.
I said, so, in case you're wondering, the husband's name was Abe and the wife's name was Dixie.
I've never heard it put that way. That's clever. That's good. And true.
Well, sometimes, you know, you have to, with this Communist Manifesto, the 10th plank being our federal school system, and especially now we see what's going on. I mean, I've got a grandson here in Georgia, and the school put in a sandbox for the kids who identified as furries.
Yes. I keep hearing that. We were actually talking about that. Obviously, now the way it goes is, you know, there are no genders. Well, actually, there are many, many countless genders, actually, and sexes, and you can go in any bathroom you want. If you just say you feel like you're a woman or a man or a boy or a girl that day, it's anything goes. But I had heard that that was going on. In fact, when we were at the book signing in South Carolina a few weeks ago, I talked to a couple of parents who said that that's going on. They're literally putting litter boxes for kids who are pretending to be animals.
Yes.
And then if you have a problem with that, you're the one with the problem.
Yeah. Couldn't be them, right?
Well, I mean, you know, what about the administration of the schools that are allowing this? I mean, you just, I actually said this. I mean, we would have more in common with Lincoln and Sherman than garden variety high school principals these days. I mean, think about that. And, you know, to the idea that for all their faults, I mean, no man's omnipotent. No man's, you know, could see the future. Could you imagine? I was born in 1980, Mike, and this is what I do. I'm a talk radio host. I cover the news. I see it. I read it. I experience it every week and offer commentary on it. And even I, who, like the frog in the boiling pot, is suffering through what America is becoming, even I struggle to believe it. And it's, you know, so much of the degenerate, you know, the outright Luciferian degeneracy aspect of it has come in my lifetime. I mean, you could say, yeah, you know, this year, this decade, this century, you know, this is where it really started. But I think the precipitous decline, I mean, this absolute free fall plummet, really just the last 20 years in terms of some of the stuff we're talking about now. And even I struggle to believe that this is happening. Could you even imagine what a Patrick Henry or a Robert E. Lee would have thought had we been able to go in a time machine and tell them what's coming? It's impossible that they would even be able to wrap their minds around it.
Well, I can tell you one thing for sure. They would disown the majority of us.
Disown the majority of us, and that
they would say you're not related to me. Sorry, go somewhere else.
I'll tell you so what.
What happened to that freedom gene we gave you?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be cliche and say it's as simple as the old what strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. Weak men make tough times. Tough times make strong men. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot that's happened to our men, from the very propaganda, from media to things they're putting in our food that could account for a lot of this. But a lot of it is just Americans have just become too comfortable and complacent. And as long as their needs are being met as an individual, they have no care for the collective, and we have to be collectivists in the sense that we have to look after our group interests, and we have to look out for one another. As you are my brother and I am your brother, and others who want to exist in these sort of communities that would resemble that of what our ancestors had in mind, I mean, we have to be there for each other. And that's too many people now, as long as they're taken care of, and as long as they are somewhat insulated from the horrors of 21st century America, then there's no problem. And anything goes, you know. I got the ball game on. I got a little bit of money in the bank. We can still take a family vacation. It's not too bad. And that's the thought. That's the mindset, I think, for too many people. And that plays into it, too.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, you know, I started doing a podcast called Whistling Dixie, and I'm going to do Whistling Dixie 25 next week. But from 17 through 24, which I thought I would get by in one podcast, I did a series called The Execution of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. I heard really good reviews about that. That was last week, right?
Several of them I've put out. The last one was last week. And the one thing I found doing this deep dive, because when I first started that, I thought I could get through the execution of Abraham Lincoln in two podcasts, no problem. Well, I'm five into it now, and I haven't finished, but I'm going to skip a little bit around because I want to cover a couple of other subjects. But here's the thing that I believe very fully after doing this research, James, is I do not believe that Abraham Lincoln was in charge of the government.
Well, if he was, he might have been the last president to be. I mean, we certainly know the president now, isn't
it? Well, and I think it's a, well, George Washington wasn't in charge of his first administration, and that was proved by none other than Thomas Jefferson. In a letter to George Washington in 1794, when Jefferson resigned as Secretary of State because he couldn't put up with Hamilton anymore, he sent a letter to Washington going, why are these things happening? Why is Alexander Hamilton, as Secretary of Treasury, proposing legislation in the Congress? He's not authorized to do that. Why are these things happening? Why do we continue to allow these things happening? Why are we creating so much debt? Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? He sent Washington 21 questions. And then Washington, who was in Mount Vernon instead of in Philadelphia where the government was, then Washington in turn sends a letter to Alexander Hamilton asking Hamilton, what's going on? Why should the president have to ask the Secretary of Treasury what's going on in his government? So I am firmly under the belief that Alexander Hamilton was the president over George Washington at that time, and he was heavily influenced by the international banking cabal.
Well, so, some things never change.
Well, that is true, and that's why I think that's one of the things we miss from history, you know, is that simple fact. But I put this, too. Let me run something very quickly by you, and then let's jump and start talking about the book.
Sure.
Here is, need anyone know more about the character of most Americans and their knowledge of history than the fact that one of the most revered characters to these people happens to be the first Marxist president who set an example of genocide against his own people that would become the template for future tyrants like Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and Idi Amin Dada? So where, you know, he set this example. I mean, you know, how many times did I hear as a kid growing up, well, you know, we talked about gun control. Well, you know, they're coming for your guns. No, they'll never do that. They'll never do that. Well, you know, and if you said today that this government would kill its own people, people would tell you, no, they wouldn't do that. Well, what the dickens do you call the Civil War? You know, and the thing that really bothers me, James, is the documentation is out there, buddy, that there were at least 500,000 blacks who died at the hands of the Union Army in contraband camps. And that's just not discussed. People just do not discuss that subject, and it's not discussed in history. But the contraband camps were all over the South. There was one in Helena, Arkansas. There was one in Nashville, Tennessee. There was one in Mississippi near Vicksburg, and it was called the Devil's Punch Bowl. And they found over 20,000 skeletons in that huge crater in Mississippi. And there were stories about it that it even appeared in the northern newspapers about what was happening to these slaves who thought after the Emancipation Proclamation, they thought they were free, so they go rushing to the Union Army. There's even a documented evidence to where suddenly the Union Army couldn't feed these people and feed their soldiers at the same time. So guess who got the short end of the stick?
Yep. Well, you know, this was one of the things, Mike, where I don't know if I'm going to take a different path from you on this. I mean, of course, when I read the harrowing stories about Sherman and the way the Union Army raped and murdered and pillaged and burned its way through the South through defenseless populations. I mean, of course, it makes my blood boil. Of course, I hope and wish and pray that he's burning in hell for that. On the other hand, this was simply the way wars were fought. I mean, you go back through antiquity, that's just you salted the fields of your enemies. And Stonewall Jackson is said to have wanted to raise the black flag and give them no quarter.
He did.
Maybe we should have had that total war against them. I think the South, to its detriment, they were too good. They were too Christian to fight that war the way that it needed to be fought to win.
That was the thing. There's two instances of that, and I forgot the special order which Robert E. Lee issued to his army when they went into Maryland for the first time in 1862. His special order to his army told them they were not to touch anything that belonged to a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
They were not to do any of that. And then we also have Stonewall Jackson coming through at that time, and I can't remember the lady's last name. I probably couldn't pronounce it right anyway, but her name was Barbara something another. And as they were passing through Maryland, she comes running out with a U.S. flag and was waving the flag. And some of the men in Jackson, under Jackson's command, threatened to go and take the flag away from her. And Jackson is reported to have been said, and it's documented by at least four witnesses, one of whom was his chief of staff at the time, Sandy Pendleton, that Stonewall told his men, anyone touches that lady, you'll die like a dog.
Yeah.
And that, again, was the difference. But here's the thing most people don't understand, James, is this atrocities, these atrocities against the people happened at the beginning of the war. It wasn't just Sherman and Sheridan. There is documented evidence in the National Archives and the Library of Congress in a 128-volume set that is titled The War of the Rebellion. This is not Southern records. This is Northern records, which document this. And how many times? I mean, there was the rape of Athens, Alabama, which is a mm-hmm. huge atrocity. And I mean, when they kill civilians, now that is the part that just doesn't ring true for anybody. But it was something that happened from the very beginning. And here's something that when you tell people this, I don't know how many people I've told this, and that you get that deer in the headlights look. I've said, how many of you people are aware that the first three states that were invaded by Abraham Lincoln's forces were still in the Union? And that was Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Went in and arrested their legislature in Maryland, put them in prison so they couldn't vote to secede.
Yeah, you'd had three more Confederate states, no doubt.
I mean, yes.
Of course, Kentucky and Missouri still get stars on the flag.
Oh, yes. And, of course, Missouri did secede, but their legislature seceded on the run. So we've got a few minutes before the top of the hour. Let's take that time, and, of course, we'll get into it on the other side, too, James. Tell us a little bit about that book while we're waiting for the break.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to do that, Mike, and because it is important to remember the history of our ancestors, it is important to honor our fathers and our mothers, and especially in a situation like this where they brought honor to our people and to our names. But we also want to continue the work that they were fighting for, much more than just revere them. We want to finish what they started, and the idea of the book, The Honorable Cause of the Free South, is that there can be a free and independent Dixie. There was a beautiful, I was telling you before, and I know we don't have too much time, so this is just to be a teaser, but I was telling you before how this series that we do every year on the political cesspool, the Confederate History Month series, is just so well received far outside of just the historic South. But certainly far beyond the shores of America itself, there was, we have received several reviews from publications in Europe and elsewhere, that the reviews themselves are almost works of art. It just, they're very passionate. There is something about this book that elicits a sense of passion that I've noticed from the people who are writing these reviews. So Remy Tremblay is a writer for a French magazine. And I'll read just a quick excerpt here from what he had to write. And he first quotes Rebecca Dillingham, who's one of the 12 contributors to this new book. And he writes that Rebecca Dillingham And she had really one of the best lines in the book, and it's included in what I'm about to read. Rebecca Dillingham summarizes the thinking of the various authors gathered in this book when she writes, quote, "America is broken. Clearly, we cannot save a nation that has no natural attributes. The United States has become a management state, an administrative juggernaut without geographical, geopolitical, or moral constraints. It is an amorphous mass comprised of polyglot territories cobbled together by secular fictions, utopian fantasies, consumerism, covetousness, degeneration, and excessive pride. Yet the South remains distinct." Indeed, the reviewer writes, "In this balkanized America, on the verge of implosion, the South has its own identity, able to resist the fall of the American empire. From these texts," and he's talking about the 12 essays that were compiled to make this book we're talking about, "the love of a country emerges, the love of a country and a culture apart." And of course, you know, Mike, I mean, this is something we say all the time. The first prerequisite for being an independent nation is to have a culture and folkways and heroes and traditions that are, you know, very much different than your surrounding geographical areas. And still to this day, the South has that. And so this book is really 12 love letters to the South, but it focuses on different aspects and elements of the South and the idea of secession and the idea of, hey, this train is going off the rails and it's not going to need any of our help. The American empire, like so many corrupt and gluttonous empires, is going to fall. And when it does, what's going to happen then? And so the idea of secession itself, Mike, is something that people are beginning to consider again. I mean, in this age of the COVID mandates and the Black Lives Matter and Antifa terrorism and everything going on in the news, I mean, there's just one thing after another the last couple of years that leads any sensible person to come to the conclusion that we have to be a separate nation. We have no future under this system. And a recent Rasmussen poll, which is, again, one of the major polling agencies out there. This isn't me and you, Mike, calling up a bunch of people and saying we ran a poll. Rasmussen says 44% of Republican voters are in favor of a national divorce. That's a euphemism for secession. We wrote a book that addresses the topic very responsibly.
Well, thanks, James. And I hear the music coming on, and we'll be back on the flip side, folks. And James is going to have to leave us a half an hour early so he can run off and make sure he gets that political cesspool going. But, folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back on the flip side of this hour. Thanks, James.
You got it. Be back with you.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.